Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm thrilled to have partnered with Mindful Chef in the second series of Food for Thought. Mindful Chef is all about convenience, quality, and balance, delivering simple, nutritious, and sustainably sourced fresh recipe boxes straight to your door. With dairy-free, gluten-free, and vegan recipes available, there is something for absolutely everybody. And what's more, for every meal sold, Mindful Chef donates a school meal to a child in need. You can save £20 across your first two boxes from Mindful Chef, plus get a free cookbook from the founders by heading to mindfulchef.com/foodforthought. Or if you use the code from this podcast, Food for Thought, when you order your first box, that will be applied. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhiannon Lambert, a registered nutritionist, master practitioner, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode of this second series, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authorities in the world of well-being, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. We're often warned about the damaging effects of technology on our health, from making our eyesight worse to anxiety-inducing social media. What about when it comes to things like step counting apps and digital GP appointments? Aren't these seen as positive aspects of technology? With new technologies emerging all the time, should we be concerned or should we be embracing them? And what does the future hold when it comes to our health? So joining me for discussion around whether technology is friend or foe is Dr. David Grimes, a physicist and cancer researcher at the University of Oxford, whose straight-talking approach can help us debunk some of the myths around the science behind emerging technology. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. I've been so excited to do this episode. It's been such a long time coming, and I just heard as well that there's a feature that came out today in the press about exactly what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, I hope I won't let you down too much.
No, so. I'm sure you won't. So I think the questions around whether technology is helpful or a hindrance to our health is often really debated, isn't it? It's something that is often very topical. And is it really as simple as, is it good or bad for our health?
I would say there's very few questions that can be stratified into good or bad. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this urge that people do to say good, you know, bad. The problem with those labels is they miss the context and the nuance. Is something good? Well, it depends on the context. Is something bad? Again, it's context specific. I always joke about radiation, which I do a lot of research on. Radiation might be really good if you're treating a tumor. It might be terrible if you're living above a radon mine. So everything matters. Context is king.
That is so true. I couldn't agree more. It's the same with nutrition. Things are often blown out of context all the time. And let's start with some of the arguments around why technology might be seen as damaging. So if we're going from that angle, so Public Health England say that we spend now an excess of 7 hours a day sedentary, and technology isn't, of course, always to blame for everything. But of course, watching TV, playing computer games, desk jobs, scrolling our phones. Surely you must have witnessed a rise in this as well.
Given that I usually work in an office, for sure. But I think that change in our lifestyle has come over several decades. Before, I guess, this renaissance of technology that we're now experiencing, where we have the entire libraries of the world's contents at our fingertips.
We do.
And it certainly is something that we need to be concerned about. If we're sitting there and we're not expending enough calories and things like that, well, it's probably not surprising that obesity rates tend to spike around that. But again, we also have to look at that as a more nuanced question. Why are we spending more time not moving? It's technology is certainly part of the answer to that, but it's not the entirety of the answer.
No. And what other aspects would you say are contributing to that?
I suppose there's been a decline in jobs that require physical labor is one thing. What we do, we've automated an awful lot of things. So you could argue that's another version of technology. But that can also be beneficial. I mean, if we can do some jobs, you know, without putting people in hazardous situations, well, that is probably a good thing.
No, it's true. But what about things even like speakers? And if you think about sound and home technologies, I think it's called, is it hybrid technology or home?
The smart techs and things like that. Yeah.
I remember being a promo, this is awful, I'm saying this on my podcast, but I was a promo girl handing out flyers once when I was a student for a home technology company, and literally you would just clap your hands and the lights would come on. Is that not making us lazy?
Pretty sure I saw that in Wayne's World years ago. But it probably is to an extent. But then I would wonder reasonably, and I'm sure we could do the calculation, but I'm sure your audience don't want to go through it, what would be the calorific expenditure of getting up off your sofa to flick a light switch versus using your phone app to do it? And I'm sure, of course, you're going to burn more calories if you move. But I wonder, is it enough, like, would just going for a walk now and then make up for that excess? I think it's very easy to look at something that's new and go, that's a bad thing, that's making us do bad things. You're like, really? Is it just an easy thing to focus on?
Yeah.
Or is it really a problem? And the answers to that will be debated for some time, even today. I'm not sure we'll get to the bottom of it.
No, it's interesting, though. I think one thing that's definitely out there is that I'm on the tube every day here in London, and posture is a big thing. I know sitting down, even now it's quite hard because we're sat on stools, and it's very difficult to remind yourself to bring your shoulders back like our grandparents once told us. Surely looking down at our phone, the tube has become a zombie zone where everybody is looking down. That can't be great for us. It must be affecting our eyesight, perhaps?
Well, funnily enough, many, many years ago, I mean over a century ago, someone made a similar critique of the novel.
Really?
That people, all these people reading books and in public transport. And if you think about it, the posture is very similar. So I wouldn't hugely think that we've changed in that much. Some people might say we've reduced our social levels of interaction.
That's true.
But the converse is we're interacting more. We're sending more messages to people as well. Is FaceTime very... I don't mean a FaceTime in the copyrighted version of it, but does that matter? Probably. And they're slightly more nuanced questions again. Is it damaging our eyesight is a very interesting one. We get asked it a lot. There is no good scientific evidence that looking at screens damages your eyes.
Okay.
There is, however, good evidence that if you look at screens at the wrong angle, say you put your monitor in a bad thing, you'll cause eye strain because you're holding your eye muscles at something that's not very comfortable for them. That's usually transient. And the way you avoid that is taking regular breaks, which we should all be doing anyway.
Well,
even though we're all workaholics, we should be taking regular breaks. And, you know, occasionally looking away and making sure that we've positioned our monitors and things like that in good locations. And if you work in an office, I think there's legal obligations for your employer to, you know, make sure you're not damaging yourself in the course of your duties.
We'd hope so. But of course, you said there's no research yet. But is there emerging research into the blue light specifically you get from your mobile phones?
So blue light, this is kind of interesting. So, and it kind of, my PhD area when I was way back when I was young was on ultraviolet radiation, which is just a step up from blue light. So visible light or all light is on a spectrum.
Yeah.
Some of which we can see, some of which we can't. And the frequency and energy, the higher the frequency, the higher the energy. And we can only see up, we can see up to about blue, and then it gets into ultraviolet A, B, C.
Okay.
So blue light has some impact on our sleeping rhythms. You know, a circadian rhythm.
Yeah.
But we get a lot more blue light from, say, the sun than we ever would from our screen. So intensity is a big issue.
Okay.
So the first thing to talk about is there is some evidence that heavy use of screens that emit a small amount of blue light they only emit a small amount of blue light, but if you're using them an awful lot...
How would you define heavy use for someone listening? There's not really a criteria, is there?
Well, funnily enough, it's in the evidence that we have, and it is quite scant, it seems to really manifest in teenagers rather than adults. It doesn't seem to affect adults the same way.
Yeah.
It is very hard to quantify screen time.
It is.
I mean, and but it's more the recommendation now is if you for good phone and sleep hygiene is to essentially a half an hour to an hour before you want to go to sleep to stop using your phone. Yeah. But even then, we have to bear in mind the blue light portion that comes out of it is relatively low. Mm. The second issue that comes from that is there's now been emerging claims from people that it's damaging your skin.
I'd love to touch on this. I've heard all sorts of things. I mean, going back to what you said before, I've heard it disrupts melatonin production. I actually had another doctor before that's claimed that, which is interesting. And damaging skin, I'm now seeing products on the shop shelves with anti-blue kind of protection. Like, should we be wearing these?
God, no. Right. So I'm going to... I'm going to put my scientist hat on now because I have... This is, again, touches on stuff we... blue light was part of a spectrum of stuff I had to study many, many years ago. Kind of kept up to date in that research. And here's the thing about it. There is no evidence in any of the studies that have been done that blue light does any DNA damage or does any collagen damage. Mm-hmm. So the problem with UV radiation, which is stuff that gives you, you know, ages your skin and gives you sunburn and things like that, and it can cause cancer, it's much higher energy than blue light. So it needs to have a certain amount of energy to cause DNA damage, either to your DNA or collagen damage. Mm. That's why you see people from Florida who sit out in the sun and they look like prunes because their collagen has been destroyed.
Yeah.
Again, I'm very anti-sunbathing.
Well,
if you want a tan,
sunscreen.
I say wear a lot of fake stuff. Don't go out in the real life.
I
That's
agree.
Researcher hat. But
I love a fake tan.
The thing about these products, and this is interesting, that I think it's Estee Lauder and people like that are selling these, I would imagine, very expensive.
They're very expensive, yeah.
But firstly, they wouldn't work. The mechanism that they're claiming would be impossible. And secondly, they are, I would say, exploiting people's lack of scientific literacy and kind of scaremongering a little bit. And I don't, as someone who's very interested in the public understanding of science, I don't think that's responsible.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes cosmetic companies have a bit of a habit of doing that.
But they do, actually. And I think I'm a person that's probably bought into every single skin fad under the sun. And it's so relieving to hear you say that. But what about another one? It's radiation. You know, hold your phone too close to your ear, or you shouldn't have it in your pocket, your jean pocket.
Yeah, I love these ones. I love these ones because this is now my current area of research. So I jump into, well, I wear a few hats.
Fabulous. Tell us about your hats
so,
as well.
Not in real life, though. I wouldn't cover up my hair. I'm quite fond of it. But yeah, so when people talk about radiation, it's kind of put down as this, and I even did it earlier on in the show. It's kind of like this kind of scary, nebulous concept. Mm. Radiation, again, visible light is radiation. Radiation is anything that radiates, right?
Of course.
So what your phone does, there's two types of radiation you could say your phone gives. The screen, the visible light you get off it, and we've kind of touched on blue light and why it's probably, unless it might disrupt your sleep, not that big of a deal. And the other kind of radiation that's associated with phones is microwave radiation.
Okay.
And this is interesting, I think, because there are so many misconceptions about it. I kind of have a funny story about this, but I'll address the misconceptions first, right? So people get very worried about microwave radiation and think, oh, I'm being exposed to it. But a photon, which is like a packet of energy, I guess, or a packet of light, the energy of a microwave photon is like a thousandth of that of visible light. It is not a powerful form of radiation.
Okay.
Visible light isn't breaking your DNA bonds or isn't causing cancer or things like that. And there's no way in hell that microwave radiation is.
Mm.
Some of the confusion comes from people going, well, microwaves can heat things, so therefore...
Well, I hear this a lot in my clinic and private practice. Can I microwave food? And I'm like, yeah, of course you can. But people still have the misconception it causes terrible things like cancers.
Because people don't fully understand it. So the way microwave heating works, it's called dielectric heating, is it just happens to have a frequency that's very similar to the vibrational frequency of water.
Right.
And if you put it in a special container, like your microwave, and you make it really, really powerful, and you focus it really, really intensely, you can vibrate water molecules, which is why you can heat stuff that has lots of water in it, but you couldn't heat your cornflakes. You can go home and microwave your cornflakes. It's not going to get that much hotter.
They probably just burn.
Absolutely. Or well, no, they won't do anything.
They won't do anything.
You can do this for fun. I mean, don't recommend people going to do this for
fun.
No,
I was imagining a foul-smelling kind of cornflake,
but not just
a thing.
Because if it is dehydrated, if there's no water in it, there's nothing to vibrate, so it just passes through. But to make microwave heating happen? A, you need hugely powerful microwave transmitters, which your microwave has. And secondly, you need to confine that in a resonant chamber. So that's not going to happen with your mobile phone. Your mobile phone is a wimpy electromagnetic radiation frequency. But this is such a common misconception that even scientists make it. So last year, a paper fell across my desk. And I sometimes get asked to check potentially bogus papers.
Of course.
And this one fell across my desk that basically said that microwaves were causing, or mobile phones were causing, cancer and autism. And it fell across the desk of a colleague and friend of mine, Professor Dorothy Bishop at Oxford. Now, Dorothy's a fellow of the Royal Society and is like one of the go-to people on autism spectrum disorders. So we'd both been sent the paper for very different reasons. But I kind of rang her and said, have you seen this nonsense? But she was like, I was about to ask you, have you seen this nonsense? So we authored a pretty comprehensive rebuttal of it.
Okay.
We basically wrote, this is an absolute falsehood. And what they had done, which is very misleading, is that they had basically taken the effects of very, very high energy radiation, like X-rays and things that can cause DNA damage, and then just basically fudged them to say, and your mobile phone could do that.
Terrible.
Unless you're carrying around a particle accelerator in your pocket, your mobile phone is not going to be causing cancer.
No.
But it's very irresponsible to claim so. And of course, one of the people involved in the paper runs a company where they sell, you know, Wi-Fi minimization products.
No surprise there.
So I felt that, you know, that's, this is why you have to be on the ball and kind of,
well,
you can't just trust everything you read is one of the problems, unfortunately.
No, and a lot of the TV shows over here in the UK at the moment, I've even seen claims that if you put your mobile phone in your jean pocket, it affects fertility, it affects men's testicles. Like, that must be a myth as well.
Well, one of the things they talked about years ago is if you heat up something. So the testicles are, I think, roughly 3 degrees colder than the rest of...
Oh, how interesting. I did not know that.
For sperm, but I think, well, I imagine it's inside. I mean, I've never taken a thermometer to mine or anyone else's, but maybe
later.
I bet
you didn't think you'd be discussing this today.
Yeah, I hadn't, you know, I just imagine people listening at home like, good Christ, that's an image that none of us wanted. But yes, the testicles are kept lower for sperm production.
Yeah.
So there was a fear that if you're, like, saying, putting a laptop or something that's emitting a lot of heat, could you damage long-term fertility?
Okay.
Probably not.
Oh, thank you. Good.
You know, again, what would you be doing? You might as well put a hot water bottle on your crotch. It would be the same problem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we technology scares us, but literally, you know.
Do you know, it's so relieving to hear all of this. And I think another area to touch on that would be quite useful is, what about the bacteria? Because there's big claims saying your phone contains as much bacteria as your toilet seat. And surely that must have a degree of truth depending how hygienic you are.
I'm sure it's approximately true no matter how hygienic or non-hygienic you may be. But I also think it's very misleading to say that, because what we're doing there is we're taking bacteria and we're going, bacteria are bad. We would die without bacteria. They're
so true.
They're everywhere. They're all over our skin. They exist inside our gut.
Yeah.
We need them a lot more than they need us.
Yeah.
So when I delved a little bit into that headline when it came out ages ago, and they took something like a toilet seat, which I imagine is bacterially not that dense. I mean, there's not that much living matter on it, and toilet seats don't really, you know, bacteria like being near living matter because they usually feed off.
Of course, so they wouldn't be on the seat.
So, but not even in high concentration. So I'm like, that's, it seems a misleading headline. What would be a more interesting thing is, are people vectoring infection because of their phone? And as far as I could tell by doing the very nerdy thing and delving through the literature, I have found nothing to say they are.
Okay.
So at the moment, I'm going to kind of go, yeah, I'm going to treat that with the, you know, a large measure of caution and a grain of salt.
Well, it's great to hear some positive aspects that social media isn't quite as scary as we thought. But what about our mental health? So I know that there's a lot of concern now, and I actually have some views on this, but I'd like to hear yours first. Do you think it's negatively impacting our health?
Well, there's
a big question.
Yeah, I'm kind of a pessimist on this a little bit. I would say yes in two ways. The first way, and maybe you can divulge more on this, because there is some evidence that suggests that it's causing serious body image problems in young women in particular, but young men as well, and even older men and women. People who spend a lot of time on, say, Instagram, there's some evidence that's linked with an increase in, you know, dysmorphia and other, you know, negative traits.
Yeah.
Because what people forget is that social media is aspirational. It's fake.
It's an image-based
platform. Yes. Oh, and
filtered world.
And I know, like, my own cases, I like to think I'm immune to mental health issues. No one is.
No.
If you are feeling bad about yourself, social media is sometimes the worst place. I mean, I even when I'm not having a good day, I limit my social media stuff. Now, obviously, I do the science outreach stuff, and that goes on my Twitter channel.
Yeah.
But I don't go and look at people's Instagram, or I don't go and look at Facebook posts, because they can make you miserable.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, my life, why is my life so crap at the moment? But they're hiding that too.
Yes,
unless
it's true.
Someone is an idiot, there's times when they're going to be miserable. And anyone who masquerades as, you know, hashtag everything fantastic is to me like, yeah, you're not telling the truth.
It's
really,
great to hear have a male perspective on that, actually, because a lot of the time, you're right, it does affect everybody. But there are a lot more women, I feel, speaking out about that side of things than men, especially in the world of science, actually, which is really good to hear. And how do you think we can combat that? I mean, if we're looking at future generations going on social media a lot more, is there a link between it inducing stress, not just body image? Perhaps it's harder to switch off. What are we going to do about that?
I have to admit that I find it sometimes makes it hard for me to switch off.
Yeah.
So one of the downsides of what I do, and I love doing, I hope I make some kind of positive impact over the past few years, but one of the things I don't like is I can often get hate mail or really vicious comments, and occasionally death threats. They're fun as well. And sometimes they're so ridiculous you can like go, oh, that's cute. But sometimes people will write something particularly vicious that just sticks in your craw.
Just a tad personal. I call those trolls. Really not very nice.
They'll find something like they'll spread a rumor or try to disenfranchise. And 99% of the time, I like to think I have a thick skin. I don't, but I like to think I do.
Yeah, I don't
I'm actually
either.
A soft git, I know. And that's not something I should admit, because that trolls will be rejoicing.
Oh, no.
But most of the time, I've learnt that this reflects on them, not me. But there's times if you're not feeling great or whatever else, that really sticks with you. And it can. So I think resilience is something we could kind of teach. But I think a bigger thing would be to overview our entire view of mental health, to say to people, look, you know, when people do this kind of stuff, it reflects on them. And we shouldn't internalize and go, what have I done? But I think it's very normal reaction to go, I must have done something, or I must deserve this.
It feels like a personal attack, and you question it because we're all
absolutely
vulnerable.
Yeah. I think the second issue with social media, and I'm sure we'll come to this a bit later on, is the propensity for disinformation and misinformation to propagate. And this is something I spend a lot of my waking hours dealing with, I particularly on topics like vaccination or alleged or ostensible cancer cures. The fact that misinformation by greatly outnumbers actual reputable sources.
Well, if you think about the questions I've already asked you, because they're the questions people want to know, that says it all, really.
Absolutely. And I spend a disproportionate amount of my time trying to debunk these myths. But it feels like throwing snowballs at an avalanche at times, because you're like, well, I can give you the full weight of a scientific consensus that I've got, and I can show you how we got there and where we arrived at these decisions. And
you feel like you don't make a dent sometimes.
It can be very frustrating when you feel that
but
way.
But I promise you are. And everybody listening is going to be taking something away from this. And how about, so we touched on mental health. We know that there's a big concern there. And I think time will tell. And obviously for future generations, that's going to be an interesting development. Like you said, perhaps the more they're exposed to it, the more resilience they will build compared to us, as we didn't have a childhood emerged in it.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that's the case. What about our sleep patterns? So I had a discussion with Dr. Chatterjee a few months ago now, and he was discussing how technology does impact our sleep and our circadian rhythms. Could you touch on that a little bit?
I believe the emergent evidence is very much that it can. And this is why there's a big movement towards improving our sleep hygiene. We do sleep less than our previous generations. However, there's still mixed evidence whether that's actually affecting us to any great degree.
Okay.
Sleep science is surprisingly complicated. Yeah. I mean, there's no straightforward answers to it. There's different schools of thought on it. But I think all of us have experienced the, you're half asleep, but you still can't put your phone down. And then it buzzes in the middle of the night, and suddenly you're like, oh, God, I have to.
I can't have my phone in my bedroom anymore, David. I have to get a separate alarm clock, because I will wake up or go to bed looking at it. It's like an addiction.
Falling asleep with it in your hand occasionally happens as well, particularly when you're drunk. But it's a weird thing. I've gone through phases of being very sleep hygienic, as in I put my phone outside the room and leave it on charge at certain times. But it depends if I have a routine or not. And currently, because I'm doing a lot of different things and a lot of different projects coming out, I'm keeping really weird hours. And the phone is kind of glued to me. And that's not always a good thing.
No.
What I've tried to do is set up, there's three or four people that actually really matter to me.
Okay.
And for different reasons, they might need contact at weird hours.
Yeah.
They have priority notification.
Yeah.
And everyone else can go and stuff until the morning or until some kind of reasonable hours. But even then, like if you're apprehensive about something or you're worried about something, I find my worst habit, and I'm not sure if you get this too, is checking constantly.
Yeah, even if there's nothing to check.
Even if you're like, well, you know, if you're apprehensive about something, I find constant checking, and then you get more apprehensive.
Yeah, like you're waiting for an email to come in, or you're looking at your own, even though you know you can't physically reply to it on the go, you will look at it.
Absolutely.
I turn notifications off on all my inboxes, WhatsApp, everything.
I think that's probably my brother does the same thing, and I think it's probably a good idea. But recently, because of different factors, I haven't been able to do that as much.
Mm. That makes it hard,
and it does make it hard. But like, it's. It's always a trade-off. It's always like, right, does this, you know, I also have I make a mistake, a lot of people do. I sometimes feel I have to reply instantly. I must, you know, or I'll let someone down.
I think that's a nice trait. You know what? I'm going with that's a nice trait because I know that feeling all too well. But is there a way that we can measure and protect ourselves? So I know some companies are putting in screen monitoring times. So you can download all these apps. Is there an average time that's scientifically proven to be better than others?
I am kind of skeptical of a lot of these screen monitoring apps because I'm not sure how much passive versus active recording they do.
Oh.
And I'm also not sure how much data we actually have to say what's right or what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If you work, I have friends who, for example, don't have a laptop. They do everything from their phone.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
What about their thumb? I mean, I think about the pain in hands. I'm just like, how does that work?
I try to do as much as I can from my array of computers and use my phone when I'm on the go.
Yeah.
Like even WhatsApp, I'll put on the app and I'll run it from my desktop most of the time.
Yes, that's exactly what we do.
Yeah, because I'm like, because I have a full keyboard then. I can type faster.
And typos are terrible sometimes. Ugh. I mean, typos on a phone, it's just embarrassing.
The best one is when you put in a typo that changes the entire context of the message. You're like, oh God, I hope.
You
can now do the WhatsApp delete for everyone. You're like, please delete that before they think I'm actually an idiot.
That was my favourite feature, deleting in a WhatsApp group. But anyway, sorry, you were saying, so with the screen time monitoring.
Yeah, I think it's very much in its infancy. So I can't give you a nice, you know, solid, the science says this, because the moment it might be like one of the old maps where they have countries they don't know, circles, there be dragons. We have no idea.
No.
And we'll discover it as we go.
Okay. And what about, so food tracking is something that I know a lot of people are a fan of. And I remember the first time a particular food tracking app came around, and it's called MyFitnessPal. I'm sure everybody listening will know of it. And it was one of the first ones to be kind of included with a phone, or you could download for free. Do you think this technology is going to grow and be accessible to everyone? I mean, I have databases, obviously, as a health professional that we use to do that, because we know these apps are not 100% accurate and they never will be. Do you see that market growing in terms of technology?
I see the market growing, but I also see a potential for risk with it, which I'm sure you do as well. I think one of the problems is that when you're, I believe most of these apps work by trying to approximate your calorific intake.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what groups like Weight Watchers were probably trying
with
pen and paper
them.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Is it productive? I'm not sure. I think some people might benefit from keeping a food diary because people do underestimate how much they eat. Mm. However, this is back to our good and bad discussion earlier on. If you have a disposition towards maybe a body image or eating disorders, this could be very destructive.
Yeah.
This, you could go, oh, I had an extra cupcake today and, you know, I'm on a spiral.
Or,
you know, if you're someone who can use it in a way that it doesn't personally affect you.
Mm.
But that, again, comes down to our relationship with food, which you know
exactly.
a lot more about than me, but also our relationship with ourselves.
Mm.
So, you know, I'd have friends who I would never recommend that to because they've struggled with images in the past. And I have other friends, like some of my nerdy friends, who just love monitoring stuff.
Well, this
and I'm like,
this
look, you go mad.
Thing.
Knock yourself out.
Yeah,
you know?
There's always new technology, and I completely agree. The first thing I say to a lot of people is delete that app. Delete any form of tracking on your mobile phone. It's not healthy. Like you said before, the kind of apprehension where you want to look at something all the time, that can become especially addictive with a mobile phone in comparison even to a food diary, like you said. You wouldn't just get your notebook out, although actually different cases of disordered eating, perhaps you would.
It might be,
But moving on from all the doom and gloom, setting all that aside, let's talk about where technology can really help us and what it can do to help our health. I mean, what do you think about your other peers in the world of science and technology? Do they agree with you that it can have a place that's beneficial?
Well, I think there is, I mean, again, going back to my disclaimer that good and bad is all context specific, oh, yeah. Something that's really important that I think that is cool is I'm currently wearing a smartwatch.
Yes.
This is the S3. I'm not getting paid by Samsung. This is literally just the
one
I have
on. No, I love a Samsung watch. I have a Galaxy one and it's really good. It's quite fun.
But the one nice thing about this is because the heart rate monitoring is pretty accurate. Now, some of the monitoring is poor. The calorific monitoring on a lot of the smartwatches is not particularly good.
Please take note of that, everybody listening, that the calories on these apps and these watches and your treadmills in the gym and all that kind of stuff, they're never accurate.
You might as well guess in some
cases.
But the data that is useful is, like, say, heart rate data. And where I see that going in the future is that we actually can get more predictive of chronic conditions that are developing. So I can say, right, I'm looking at the rate here. There was a paper recently on this. I think Leeds University did it last year. I'm monitoring a particular type of cardiac problem that some people can have. And they were able to detect it in their cohorts using smart, and before it ever had manifested as a problem. So prevention is better than cure.
I completely agree.
I mean, in everything from cancer to cardiac issues, for sure. So using this kind of this data to predict that and to be able to better, you know, make interventions, that would be fantastic. The caveat with that is that a lot of people say, oh yeah, well, that's what the companies will do in Facebook. I don't, and this sounds very paranoid of me, but I'll explain why. This is not the kind of data that you want private companies to analyze, because when they use their fancy algorithms and tell you something, you have no idea if that is actually really predictive, because it's all proprietary. If it's done academically and open sourced and people say, like, I want to give that data to a project, then you can see how it was arrived at, and scientists can pick at the conclusions and go, is that accurate or not? But we've already seen now a lot of companies, and with genetic data you see this a lot, like these 23andMe companies, they get your data and then their algorithms that say, oh, you're X percent from this, they don't tell you how they get there, and when you retest them, they don't have good retestability. So I think if we're going to do open data about health data, it has to be open. But that is probably a bit of a nerdy divergence.
I think that's really useful for people to hear, because whenever you conduct a study or you collate a lot of research, there's different step-by-step methods and things that have to be done to make it valid, to make sure that what you do can be repeated and you'll get the same result time and time again.
Absolutely.
So what Dave has basically just said is that, you know, why would they want to take our dodgy data from our watches?
or at least if science isn't reproducible, it's not science.
Like, exactly.
If we all do the same experiment, we should all get roughly the same result for the same population.
Completely.
So if
me in a lab when I was back at uni, and honestly,
this is why I'm mainly a theorist, because, but it is a concern, and I mean, it's more a concern with genetic data, but if companies hold this themselves and then they claim they've got an algorithm, algorithms are a lovely buzzword, but all they mean is they're a step of, I analyze this to get there.
So can you explain an algorithm
to
everyone? Because I think most people relate to it with a platform like Instagram. Like,
sure. So all an algorithm, I can't even say it. English is hard. All an algorithm actually is a series of steps.
Okay.
It's basically, so an algorithm for you can look at it in a mathematical way. Take this function, square it, do this, subtract, right?
Okay.
So it's a recipe, what you do to data. And say when you look at your Instagram and your Facebook, they'll be like, people who like this, we have noticed like this, so we'll recommend this to this. Right? So it's a series of steps. Now, these companies deliberately keep their algorithms opaque. They don't want you to know about them. But good science, which uses algorithms all the time, they should be so open. You should say, so you go, how did you come to that conclusion? And we should go, well, actually, we found this and we did this. And here's, you should be able to reproduce it.
Of course.
Private companies, they like to keep it proprietary. They do not want you to know it. So Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and Instagram, they have their own proprietary algorithms.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they're smart. Like, I mean, it's a fancy word and people think it sounds smart.
Yeah.
It literally is recipe. It's a series of steps which they try to keep hidden from you.
Everyone complains about that recipe on a daily basis, I feel. But you're right in terms of the government definitely getting involved with technology a lot more. I mean, there's now plans in England that patients are going to have access online to a GP kind of 24 hours a day via your mobile phone, different health apps. This is obviously for medical advice. Now, I'm kind of on the fence with this is a wonderful idea, and obviously, but it's not going to be applicable to everybody, is it? What are your thoughts there?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, I guess it comes down to severity. So I guess if you want to reduce, I mean, all health services are always going to be up against the wall, and the NHS for sure.
Yeah.
So if you can reduce the amount of, you know, physical hours that people have to queue up, and that would be beneficial. But I would imagine they're always going to have to err on the side of caution. If I did this online consultation, say I have chest pain, I imagine any reputable doctor will go, look, you can't take a risk on that. You'll have to come in. But what you can do is stratify. If someone goes, oh, well, they have a bit of a runny nose, and is like, which people do. People still go to the doctor for colds and flus.
I know.
And we've been telling people for decades, stay at home. You literally infect everyone else in the room,
don't
and you're not. So if people stop doing that, that would be great. And it would also not waste as much time. If someone, like doctors are, I go occasionally to doctors, but they, you know, they're massively stretched for time.
Of course.
And a lot of the reason for that is that they're dealing with some things that, you know,
aren't always necessary.
Are trivial or not necessary. There's also a pressure now, it's more so in the US. There was a pressure on doctors for years that patients would come with, say, something that would self-clear. It was self-limiting, like a head cold or something, and would demand antibiotics.
Well, yes.
And this was a huge issue because we are seeing a massive upspike in antibiotic resistance. Diseases that you could once treat easily are now immune to it because people have irresponsibly used antibiotics, and eventually these things develop a resistance to them. Like there are, I don't want to scare people, but there are treatment resistant gonorrhea strains going around and things like that. We can't cure anymore. Like a disease that we could literally cure with a pill a few years ago. And there's diseases that, you know, there's resistant infections now that are starting to kill people that none of our antibiotics work against, which used to work no problems.
It's very scary. Do you think there's a link with gut health there perhaps as well with the antibiotics?
Quite possibly. But I would say what the bigger factor here is that for many, many years, people they go to a doctor, and if a doctor said, you're grand, go home, cop yourself on, they wouldn't accept that. And I think there was a pressure, and I've certainly spoken to some of my medical friends, to if someone is very pushy, they won't leave without a prescription for something. So they write them a prescription for antibiotics. Now that is being incredibly discouraged, but we've done that for years, and there are definitely still people, that doctors, that give in to that pressure. I think we need to, at least if you went to your online consultation and you said, I have a head cold, I need an antibiotic, the guy'd say, no.
That is
just
true.
Stop.
But when it comes to AI, I mean artificial intelligence, do you think we're at the point where we've got robots operating on people's bodies, or does it go that far?
Well, AI is often a lot dumber than people think it is. Like, it's like you see these chatbots that become racist very quickly, because all AI does is it uses, again, algorithms, sometimes open, sometimes closed, to try and learn things. It looks at this big set of data and says, is this associated with that? But firstly, it finds a lot of spurious kind of not real connections. And otherwise, you can bias it. I mean, that Microsoft found this to their detriment when they put on that clever chatbot that suddenly became really racist and started giving out conspiracy theories, because the kind of people that were giving it the input were not representative, I hope to Christ, were not representative of the whole. So that's one thing. Arguably, we already have robots doing surgery, or I should be more specific, performing procedures,
because
for example.
That's quite scary when we say that.
Well, in radiotherapy, for example, your automated gantries, which I see all the time.
Yeah.
Now, there's always a human standing there coding it up. You know, if you're getting a radiotherapy treatment, someone has, a physicist usually, there's lots of us working in medicine, has gone out there and done the radiation prescription plan to work out what you should get. And that giant rotating arm gantry is essentially a robot delivering it that. Mm-hmm. And there's other forms of precision medicine that are coming in as well. But that is not to say that the human element will ever be. It shouldn't be.
No.
You wouldn't want someone for it. You know, even if the robot's really good, you want human supervision.
Yeah,
so it might
of course.
Make the job quicker and more accurate.
Yeah.
But you can never take the human out of the equation. And no one in healthcare would want the human taken out of the equation.
No, definitely not. We've already got self-driving cars that are problems, haven't we? We don't need it in our healthcare. And I think when it comes to personalised health, do you see the future being a point where we're even tracking? I mean, for instance, we're tracking fertility now on apps.
We're tracking it badly. Let's be very fair.
Okay, great. Can you explain to everybody, because I see this everywhere, they are not 100% accurate.
They're not even close.
There we go.
Here's the thing, right? These apps, this always reminds me of a bunch of people that half read a biology textbook in secondary school and said, we can make an app based on a cycle. Great. Forgetting, so I'm doing with a bunch in Ireland at the moment, we're doing lectures in schools on debunking reproductive health myths.
Oh, great.
Now, I mainly focus on the HPV vaccine, but there's someone there focusing on contraception and periods. And one of the things about you know, one's menstrual cycle is there's a lot of uncertainty on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is so many other factors that an app, nothing could track. Like they're not measurable factors. Like even people going, oh, I'll use my vaginal mucus. That is a horrible phrase, but there you go. Even then you're like, that doesn't, no, the uncertainty.
Temperature's another one. Yes. People are taking temperature.
But are they taking, like, are they taking it accurately?
No.
And even if they were, it's only an indication. So you'd need to look at all of these things in concert. People don't do that. And there is this idea, and it's the tech bro idiot version, where people go, yeah, technology will solve that problem. And I just want to grab these people in Silicon Valley and bang their head off a table and go, no, you are stupid, stop.
Oh, dear.
Well, the classic one a few years ago was Elizabeth Holmes, and I think it was Theranos. And she had this big, huge company that promised you that from a prick of your blood, it could diagnose all these conditions.
Terrifying.
But all these statisticians and medical experts and people were going, that's impossible. It's not just impossible with the tech, it's impossible full stop, because you get all these, your uncertainty would be so high, like the fertility apps, that it would mean nothing. Yet she generated $9 billion in investments for a company, which is the old adage about fools and their money being soon parted. But it's insane. So people who think you can have technological solutions to biological problems are often big on tech, low on biology.
Okay, thank you. That was a very clear, cutthroat answer there.
I'll
loved
get hate
it.
Mail for that one, I'm
no,
sure.
No, no, it was
tech bros.
Great. There is no hate mail on the Retrition channels at all. We are putting a stop to anything like that. So, what about YouTube? Just throwing in the whole YouTube question before we take some questions.
I wish we had alcohol here, I'll tell you that.
I know, I know.
What about YouTube? So, one of my major interests is vaccination policy.
Yeah.
Right. Partially because, for example, HPV is responsible for 5% of all cancers.
Oh my goodness.
Not just, it's almost all genital cancers and anal cancers, but 5% of all cancers. Mm. We could eradicate them tomorrow. Well, okay, we need a bit more time, but we have the means to eradicate them. We have HPV vaccines for several years now. It's super effective. And yet, around the world, there's concerted movement against it. In Japan, misapprehension about the vaccine brought coverage rate from 70% to 1% within a year. Ireland went from 87% way down to 50%. Denmark went down as low as 17% from 79%. And most of these campaigns started on social media, but YouTube is a great offender. So you go on there, and I'm just taking the HPV vaccine as one example. I could do it with any vaccine.
No, this is a good example.
You go on and you type in HPV vaccine, and you put in safe or dangerous, a modifier. And the vast majority of the stuff you encounter is telling you that this is apocalyptic. This is a terrible thing and it's killing people. They're terrifying, these documentaries. The one is called like Sacrificial Virgins, all this kind of scary stuff.
Gosh.
It's nonsense. When I give talks to school kids on this, now I do a lot of this in I've written about it for The Guardian or The Irish Times or talked about it on BBC. But when I even do outreach with school kids, one of the first questions I ask, particularly to younger girls, is who's heard about this vaccine? What have you heard? And what they've heard and where they've got it from is really eye-opening. You hear, they hear it's going to ruin their fertility. It's going to, you know, be worse than getting HPV, everything. And I'm looking at this kind of going, have you ever been close to someone that's had cervical cancer? Yeah. Or, you know, here's, this is, it prevents it. And mm. and that is a really important message to get across.
We had awareness in this country around the time Jade Goody, I don't know if you remember, that was a huge, terrible thing,
boosting cervical smears, that went up massively. Yeah. But here's the thing about celebrity coverage, right? Yeah. And I've been quite interested in that for years, how celebrities can bolster or damage impact things. So Jade Goody, very unfortunate, and died very young of cervical cancer. And her diagnosis boosted cervical smears by, I think it was a 4 or 5 year high. It was quite high. But only a few years after her death, they fell to a 19-year low. So one of the things about this is that celebrity coverage has a half-life. People are very interested at the time, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily a lasting message. Kylie Minogue's breast cancer diagnosis caused a spike in mammograms in Australia, which was actually detrimental because the kind of people getting mammograms were young women, and mammograms are useless for young women. They'll give you false positives all the time. Okay. So there were people requesting mammograms who really didn't need them and would probably be given a concerning diagnosis that isn't a real diagnosis. Cervical smears are very, very important. They're a wide net that is supposed to catch, you know, it'll miss a few cases, it'll catch a few markers, but overall they save lives and it's kind of beneficial. But screening tests are only appropriate for the people they're directed for.
But that's why the problem with having channels, because now the new TV is YouTube, is that it's not really regulated. Anybody can say anything.
It's the Wild West. There's no regulation whatsoever.
I'm very happy we managed to cover that question, actually, in that topic. It's really important for everyone. And there's lots of questions that people have asked me to ask you. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
I know. Here we go. So you haven't seen any of these.
I haven't.
I know. So Saskia has said, I have two young boys who spend a lot of time playing computer games. I'm sorry, you're not alone there, Saskia. Should I be worried about this potentially damaging their health?
I'd have to confess that I spent a disproportionate time playing computer games as well.
How did I know that was coming?
Because I'm a physicist, I guess. we don't have many friends. No, I joke. I hope I joke. So I guess the big test for that, and again, putting the caveat that I wouldn't necessarily be an expert in child development, what I would say is, if the boys are playing a lot of games but they're still interacting socially and they're doing well in school, then I don't think it's any different than if they're watching a bit of TV or doing anything like that. In fact, it might even be more interactive because a lot of people play games and they make friends. The only other thing to be concerned about in the modern era is when people are playing online games, and if kids are young, who are they interacting with?
Yeah.
And that is, there's no substitute for parental, just checking in now and then. Saying,
and of course, activity levels as well, like we were looking at before. I mean, has video gaming replaced, from my perspective, I don't know, outdoor games?
Yeah, and there's a balance that has to be struck.
Yeah.
My parents were quite good because my brother and I used to love playing games, but they'd all say, you can have a certain amount of hours on the weekend and maybe something during the week, but you've got to get your stuff done and you've got to spend time outside.
Yeah.
So everything's about striking a balance. And playing the games themselves is probably not going to be that detrimental as long as it's not at the cost of other things.
Well, this is kind of leads me on to the next question. So Maria has said she mindlessly, and we've kind of covered this, but she says she mindlessly spends hours on her phone without realising. What kind of tips to cut down on that, or does she need to? You know, like we've discussed.
I sometimes do it myself, but it's usually when I'm trying to procrastinate over something, and that's not always from a mental health perspective the best thing to do. I think you sometimes have to force yourself, and again, this is just from my own perspective, I have no expertise on this. I think sometimes you have to force yourself to kind of go, right, I'm going for a walk now, I'll put the phone in my pocket or leave it at home or whatever else.
It's habit.
And I'll do something. And once you get into the swing of doing something, you can often just feel a lot better. The phone is it's a pacifier for us sometimes. It's like, I'll just like scroll through my news feed on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever else, hoping something interesting happens. And reality, it usually won't. Maybe scrolling through the current news feed in the UK might be terrifying. But you know what I mean? So I think there is a level that if you're doing it a lot, there is a potential that could be bad for your mental health, or could be reflective of you, you know, not being particularly happy in something else. And that, these are questions that you have to look to yourself to answer and say, do I need to find something else, or do I need to talk to someone? That's the only thing I'd be wary of there. Like, I've been often scrolling. When you're procrastinating, you're often stressed or upset or something about, so
What's the coping mechanism that you've got to deal with that? And James has asked, is it affecting my eyesight? Can I damage my eyesight by looking too much at the phone.
You can strain your eyes, like, but that's usually transient. I'm not sure how many people have dropped a phone in their face or a laptop in their face. I have done all of these things. The laptop hurt a lot more than the phone. But that could hurt your eyes.
Yeah.
But overall, the kind of damage done by screens will be transient and usually can be avoided by, you know, good ocular health.
Okay, so Ollie has said, oh, this is a bit out there, will technology ever enable us to live forever?
That's an interesting one. People talk about things like consciousness transplants, and there's an idea that we could upload our brains to, you know,
it's like a Hollywood movie, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a lovely idea, except the brain is a horrifically complicated organ.
That we don't have the answers for yet fully still.
Well, I'm not sure we ever will. I mean, the interconnections of your neurons, you're talking about billions upon billions upon billions of things interconnected in this intricate way that is
mind-blowing.
Very hard to replicate. And even if you could, I mean, we might one day get the technological capacity to do that. But would, and then you get into the philosophical question, would that be you?
Yeah.
Would that be an approximation of you? I don't know.
Okay.
Who wants to live forever anyway?
All right. No, exactly. I love that song though. It's a Queen song, isn't it?
I'm a big Queen fan. So
legend.
I'm glad you
Are
spotted
you really?
The reference. I was a Queen fanatic.
So moving on to my favourite part of the podcast, and this is called Fact or Fiction, the Quickfire Round.
Oh, good Lord. I'm in trouble. Okay, hit me.
Are you ready? So you've got to answer fact or fiction.
I'll try.
Okay. Phones are bad for our health.
It depends.
Good stuff.
Faction, maybe?
I like that.
It depends how we use them. So definitely good and bad. I'm very against these.
Faction is genius. We haven't had that answer yet. Okay. Anyway. Our screen time is increasing.
I would imagine that's probably true.
We should clean our phones more often than our toilet seats.
We shouldn't clean our toilet seats with our phones, that's for sure. I think as long as both your toilet seat and your phone are relatively clean, you're going to be fine.
Okay. Sleep is affected by looking at our screens before bed.
It can be, and the way to avoid that is to minimise phone usage before you want to sleep.
Excellent. Hundreds of years from now, robots will replace all healthcare professionals.
I wouldn't extrapolate too far in the future, but they'll definitely help. Okay. I mean,
oh my gosh, that's scary. Phone screens age our skin.
No, not true.
Technology can cause cancer.
I got to qualify that one. If you, say, looked into a LINAC or a particle accelerator, you'd probably get cancer. But most people aren't carrying those things around in their house.
No.
So your household electricity and your household electric devices.
And your microwave.
And your microwave, you're grand. Don't put things in your microwave like cats or anything. That would be horrible. That wouldn't be good for them. But
it's not humane.
of all things, yeah.
Technology is creating new health problems we didn't have before.
Possibly in some ways, it's also helping other ones. So, you know, faction again.
There we go. Healthcare will one day be completely personalised.
I'd argue to a large extent healthcare already is. Certainly in my area of cancer research, every patient gets their own prescription, their own dose plan. I think that'll go further and further. And I think that's good. So I think we are. But I think people underestimate how personalised medicine is.
We need another episode just on immunotherapy and all these different types of things out there, because I would love to discuss that.
Sure, so we can do a cancer episode sometime.
Yeah, we're going to have to plan that. Technology will positively impact our health in the long term.
I think in the long term, yes, but we have teething problems right now where we don't, and a lot of that's mental health, like, I mean, which is as important as physical health, but we don't necessarily have the best relationship with our tech. But when we get there, well, it's always good to have extra monitoring and things like that, as long as we know how to use it responsibly.
Yeah.
So it's all about responsible usage.
That's very true. And that nearly wraps up the episode. But with every guest, we finish with a food for thought. So in an ever demanding and increasingly stressful world, as we've discussed, we're now subject to more information than ever before. Obviously, we don't want you going to YouTube, like we've said. Technology does provide us with an endless supply of content at our fingertips. And I find it can sometimes make it hard for me to switch off. We've both said that that's quite a difficult thing. And in this respect, the mindfulness boom has never been more important. So this is something that I work on a lot with my clients in Harley Street, and it's at the very core of a healthy body. So we're often distracted by what's going on around us, and that we're no longer truly present in a world that we live in. We miss out on things that are more important to us. And it's as we discussed before, David, you said, I've got a few notifications I want to see. I've got a lot that I don't want to see. But our nutrition, in my kind of viewpoint, deserves at least an equal thought and consideration. And I'm always reminded that you know, food has to undergo a complex biological process in the body, which takes time, and it involves a lot more interactions than a simple mouth-to-stomach pathway. So good digestion starts with taking time to eat properly, to eat mindfully, not scrolling your phone and eating at the same time, which I think a lot of people do. You'll be more likely to experience digestive discomfort if you're not concentrating and eating in a way that we're meant to naturally eat. So ultimately, allowing you to fully enjoy your food is kind of something that I think we should be aiming for. So if I could ask you, David, to finish today's episode with your food for thought that you want to give the listeners, it could be anything, what would that be?
I think the most important thing, and this kind of, I feel like I'm repeating myself a bit because I say this in a lot of my columns or a lot of my interviews. One of the most important things we all need to learn is how to differentiate our sources of information. We live in an era where the world's repository of information is literally at our fingertips, and yet misinformation has never been more common or more propagated. And there's good evidence that misinformation spreads further and deeper than reliable sources. And this can have huge detrimental impacts on our health. It can be dietary. I mean, there's people that believe the keto diet can cure cancer, things like that. That's not
true. Carnivore diets now.
All this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. The things that people ought to be wary of, I think, are simplistic messages. Because most things are not simple. Most things are complicated. Mm-hmm. Like everything in life, if it's straightforward, it's probably not true or very, very reductive. But also learning how to question things. And it's always good to question things. Even you go, okay, how do we know? Just how do we know that? Where do we get that from? Why would you tell me that? Mm. So how do we know that is what we should ask. Is that information true? Okay, where did you get it from?
Where?
So did it come from, say, the World Health Organization, or did you pull it off some crank website like Mercola.com? Because if you did,
oh, goodness, it's at the top of every search engine.
Do you know what? Unfortunately, he gets more views on his cancer articles than the National Cancer Center, an institute in the USA.
It's like the medical media we've got at the moment.
Yeah, I have. He's mentioned in my upcoming feature work.
Yes.
But the other thing to say as well is, why would you tell me that? If someone is trying to sell you something, which is often the case, this supplement will prevent cancer, and then they're trying to sell it to you, be they Alex Jones or some naturalistic health guru, the question is, well, you kind of have a vested interest in selling me that, don't you? Mm. So reputable sources, learning to identify them. And that is not a Facebook meme. That is not an Instagram share. That is not some, you know, celebrity on Twitter saying something. You know, it is asking and teaching people a question. And the most important thing we can do for our health and our well-being is learning to say, okay, how do we separate the noise from the signal?
I love that.
It's not easy, but we can all learn to do it.
Well, that is brilliant, David. And I think for a lot of people, they're going to take so much away from this episode. So thank you so much, especially at the end, the how, where and why. It's really, really good information for people to implement. But how can we find out more about you? Have you got any projects coming up that people could invest into?
Sure. So I'm most active on Twitter. I'm trying to learn my Instagram. I have a very good friend who's helping me learn it, but I still suck at it.
Well, it's like you said before, it's a tough world on Instagram.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, my Twitter usage is okay. I kind of use that fairly regularly. And I have a website, davidrobertgrimes.com.
And is your Twitter handle the same?
At DRG1985. Sure.
Perfect.
I suppose I can probably announce this now. I have a book coming out sometime later on in the year called The Irrational Ape.
Amazing.
And it's about how we can learn to, you know, differentiate useful information from absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
And why it is more important than ever in an era of Brexit and Trump and all these kind of things. It's not just about your health or about science. It's about how do we find claims and what mistakes do we make? Why do we fall for stuff? So I got really interested in that, and that book will be coming out under Simon & Schuster some stage in the year, I believe around August or September. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to tell people that, but screw it, the microphone's here. So it's
well,
done.
We appreciate it. Gosh, a first glimpse in. Well, I for one will be getting that, and I'll be dropping all links for anybody that wants to know more. And when we have the information about the book, we'll be putting that out there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. It's heartening to know there's such a craving to hear from expert voices in a world full of confusing nutritional advice. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll love what's coming next week, so click subscribe to be the first to hear it, and please do leave a 5-star review. It really does help get our podcast out there and hopefully help more people.
For more information about my Retrition Clinic, books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Variety really is the spice of life, and I, for one, thoroughly enjoy trying new flavors and cuisines when it comes to my food. In fact, eating a variety of foods can help you manage your weight, improve general well-being, and reduce the risk of so many conditions. Mindful Chef recipes are all about taste, and with so many recipes to choose from, they make every day an opportunity to try something new. To order tasty recipes from Mindful Chef, head to mindfulchef.com/foodforthought, where you can save £20 across your first two boxes. You will also get a free cookbook written by the founders so you can continue to experiment in the kitchen.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.